may take a little time for you to digest because so many people are accustomed to praising the effectiveness of the home mortgage interest deduction. You won't be alone if you admit you were fooled. In fact, when the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform released its proposals for reform, the one proposal it made that nobody argued with was restructuring the home mortgage interest deduction to ensure that the dominant portion of the benefit would go to low and middle income Americans. Like so many others, however, even House Speaker Nancy Pelosi misunderstands who receives the giveaway that is the home mortgage interest deduction today. She railed against the panel's report, claiming that it would demolish the building blocks middle-class Americans use to reach the American dream. The president's tax panel would severely limit the mortgage interest deduction. You know, she's right. The panel did propose limiting the deduction, but not for anybody in the middle class. The panel's target was limiting the benefit for those with seven-figure homes or second homes in vacation locales, the theory being that if you have either, you probably don't need a government subsidy to help you with your interest payments. Let's talk some more about the effect of the fair tax on the sale of new homes. Even though the fair tax makes the mortgage interest deduction irrelevant, not only will housing be more affordable, but home buyers will have more money to use in buying a home. Here's why. Roughly three-quarters of home sales involve existing homes, which wouldn't be taxed under the fair tax. And unlike today, taxpayers could use untaxed earnings to buy those homes. Is this sinking in? If you buy a previously owned home, there's no fair tax. And what's more, you're buying that home with what would today be called pre-tax money. Realtors sell houses based on how much income a buyer brings home each month. They use the mortgage interest deduction to show the potential buyer that the tax advantage will increase his or her take-home pay. So let's say a buyer makes $60,000 per year and takes home about $3,800 a month. By using the tax calculation, he or she may be able to get the take-home pay up to $4,000 a month. The extra $200 a month may be just enough to convince the prospect that he or she can afford a new home. Now, what if that realtor could somehow increase the prospective home buyer's income by $1,200 a month instead of just $200? Do we see an even larger home in the picture here? Plus, fair tax studies show that interest rates could decline by as much as 24% with the fair tax. That new home is getting bigger all the time. Now it may even have a swimming pool out back. There is one group out there that won't see the good news in the scenario we're painting for you. What are Washington lobbyists going to do if home buyers can buy houses with untaxed earnings and if the mortgage interest deduction becomes a needless relic of a past tax system? Well, let's just say they aren't going to be proposing toast to the fair tax at their favorite K Street watering holes. You can see how the advantages from the fair tax are starting to add up. Mortgage debt will be paid at a 25% lower interest rate, and unlike in the current tax code, the fair tax would fully untax any capital gains from the sale of used or new homes. It would also enable prospective homeowners to save a down payment faster by increasing their take-home pay and not taxing their savings. But one more thing. As we've said, the fair tax is easy to attack. And its critics will surely tell the Americans that the fair tax is going to add 23% to the cost of every new home. We have quite a few letters from elected officials saying just that. The same principles apply to new home construction as apply to everything else you purchase in the retail marketplace. Every new home today carries an embedded tax. The combined tax burden of all of the suppliers of material and labor involved in building that home. With the fair tax, the embedded tax burden is removed. It is replaced by the fair tax. You're replacing one tax with another. You're not increasing the price of the home. The deeper message here is that many ideas about our tax code are based on long held misunderstandings of how the tax code operates, misunderstandings so pervasive that they permeate even the highest levels of government. Bringing about a fair tax change would be hard enough if everyone understood the lay of the land today. But we have much more work to do, starting with correcting all the misunderstandings that have been sold to the American people. Thank goodness we have a team of thousands. Okay, the next criticism: ending the tax-deductible status of charitable contributions will destroy America's charitable organizations. Some charities have expressed concern that their flow of contributions will dry up if the income tax advantage disappears. We've encountered this particular objection to the fair tax many times. Frankly, we are at a complete loss as to how to make any sense of this at all. The truth is that the incentive for giving to charitable organizations would not be diminished in any degree by the fair tax. In fact, it would increase. Okay, here's how. Under the current system, when you donate money to a qualified charity, you're permitted to deduct the amount you donated from your taxable income. So, to make the math easy, let's say your tax bracket is 25% and you donate $1,000. The charity gets $1,000, and you get to lower your taxable income by that same amount, by $1,000. You have a 25% tax rate, so that means your tax bill goes down by $250. Okay? Please tell us, under what set of logical operating principles would a person give away $1,000 just to save $250 in taxes? The answer is none. The happy truth is people give their monies to charities because they feel charitable. We've long since concluded that money is given less for tax reasons than for reasons of love and caring. The more money people have in their pockets, the more of their paycheck they're going to be allowed to keep, the more likely it is they're going to give to charity, and the more money they are likely to give. Your authors have seen this in our own lives. Our mothers never had an income in their lives that exceeded the poverty level, yet they never failed to give to the church or to the Girl Scouts. People give money away when they have money, any amount of money in their pockets, and we're going to put more money in their pockets. The generous spirit of Americans runs very deep. We give more when we have more. In 1980, when the value of a contribution at the margin was 70%, we gave about $43 billion to charities. In 1988, when the value of a contribution at the margin was 28%, we gave $88 billion. The 1980s were good to Americans, and we simply had more to give in the latter part of the decade. Some of the nation's greatest fortunes, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, their fortunes were given away when there was no tax deduction for charitable giving at all. At the risk of overkill, here's even more evidence that the fair tax won't have an adverse impact on charitable giving. After the 1986 Tax Reform Act, charitable giving increased rather than decreased, despite the lowering of marginal income and transfer tax rates. Charitable giving rose by $6.4 billion, or 7.6%, in 1987, after the top tax rate fell from 50% to 28%, more than doubling the tax price of giving. Likewise, the growth of charitable bequest was most rapid from 1980 to 1987, when estate taxes were coming down. According to Giving USA 2004, charitable contributions totaled $240.7 billion in 2003. Of this amount, according to IRS data, 61% or $145.7 billion was claimed by the 30% of individual taxpayers who itemized deductions on their 2003 federal tax returns. When the effect of the increase in income from the fair tax is combined with the effect of the change in the price of giving for both itemizers and non-itemizers, recent research by Beacon Hill Institute finds that charitable donations should increase by $2.06 billion. That's about a 1% increase in the first year, an increase of 2.4% within 10 years, and an increase of 5% after 20 years. These increases are in comparison to a baseline in which the current ugly tax regime continues. So when do people increase their giving, and when do they cut back? The key to these fluctuations is the economy, not the tax burden. Over the past 40 years, the level of annual donations has tracked personal income growth almost exactly. When the economy is up, along with personal income, Americans give. When the economy falls off a cliff, so does charitable giving. Americans are always generous, but the key to sustaining their giving is keeping the economy booming. Economists have consistently predicted a sustained boom in the American economy once consumption taxes replace income taxation. This will drive charitable giving to new heights. So it's clear, charitable institutions have nothing to fear from the fair tax. Next criticism, the transition cost of moving to the fair tax would be unmanageable. When discussing a significant change in the tax code, particularly when it involves throwing out the entire tax code and replacing it with something new, serious people ask what the transition cost is going to be. It's a good question, but many of us believe the benefits outweigh the cost, no matter how high those costs might be. The Retail Federation isn't what you might call fond of the fair tax. When they came calling, they argued that they would be forced to buy new point-of-sale cash registers to handle the change. We were stunned. Surely they were kidding. Were they really willing to scuttle a great tax reform idea because they were going to have to buy new cash registers? For that matter, were they actually trying to convince us that the computerized cash registers in general use today couldn't handle the fair tax calculations? Come on, let's get real. These new generation cash registers can figure out a sale involving 10% off on all purchases over $39.99 and 15% off when the total gets to $99.99, but they can't figure out an inclusive 23% sales tax? There are 85,525 units of local government in the U.S. In the states that have a local or county sales tax, the rules change regularly. In Georgia, we have a special purpose local option sales tax, a device localities routinely use to collect funds for school construction or other infrastructure improvements. Is our local target forced to run out and buy a new cash register every few months? Probably not. We're guessing it makes a programming adjustment and never misses a beat. Now, with that worry put to rest, let's look at one transition rule in H.R. 25. Let's assume the fair tax goes into effect on January 1, 2009. If a business has any inventory on hand as of December 31, 2008, a percentage of the value of that inventory can be used as a credit against the amount of tax due in the following year. That's because tax has already been embedded in the cost of that inventory along the line of its manufacturing, and we don't believe anything should be taxed twice. At any given time, there's roughly $2 trillion in inventory in America. Thus, the amount of the inventory credit would be about $600 billion. Businesses would apply for the credit as their inventory is sold and have up to 18 months to claim the credit. Does that seem hideously expensive? Not from where we sit. Remember, too, that the $600 billion in embedded taxes in that inventory are taxes that have already been collected. So the cost of the transition in terms of government revenue is actually zero. Glenn Hubbard, a former economic advisor to President Bush, isn't a fair tax supporter. But even he told the House Ways and Means Committee that the transition would be uneventful. Alan Greenspan has said the same thing. The very idea of a transition cost raises some interesting questions. Have you ever worried about a sit-and-do-nothing cost? Or an avoid-taking-a-stand cost? How about the let the current tax code continue until it destroys America cost? There may be some dislocations and hiccups as a result of the move to the fair tax, but compare those with the economic disaster that's coming if we keep our current tax system. Someone will definitely lose his or her job as a result of the move to the fair tax, but our market will be flooded with new jobs to replace it. You can't worry about transition costs. We're more concerned about the failure to transition cost. They might be too high for our nation to pay. And the next criticism? This seems like a lot of trouble. Wouldn't a simple flat tax be easier? The answer is simple. Been there, done that. And all we got was this lousy tax code. Would a flat tax be easier? Probably. Would it be better? No way. This flat tax versus fair tax debate is one we love. Not because we love a challenge, it's because we love debates we can win easily. History lesson, folks. The tax system we have today, the one we've come to know and love, began 94 years ago as a flat tax. The monstrosity you see today is a flat tax on income after nearly a century of very imperfect evolution. At first, only a very small percentage of Americans were asked to pay income tax. In fact, that's how they sold it to us, as a tax on the rich. Well, that all changed with World War II. The cost of the war effort led to an expansion of those who paid federal income taxes, and we were off to the races. The tax code was flattened again, if you will, in 1986. Since that time, amended 16,000 times. Now we have more than 67,000 pages of statutes and regulations, and that helps explain why last year nearly two-thirds of all tax filers had to seek professional help with their tax return. You must know that under the present system, the chances of having an absolutely accurate tax return filed on your behalf are near zero. If you earn any significant income at all and you try to prepare your own tax return, your chances of preparing one that is error-free are really less than zero. Better, you should try to win the lottery. Then again, if you call the IRS for help, your chances of ending up with the correct answer are less than 60%. Where does all this leave us? With a tax code that's wholly inefficient in raising the necessary monies to fund the government, and that's putting it kindly. And it gives us a code that politicians love to use to tell you how to live your life. Remember, a flat tax is nowhere near as comprehensive a solution for our problems as the fair tax. Under a flat tax, we'd still be facing payroll tax deductions, you'd still have to report your income, and the IRS would still be there to pry into your personal financial affairs. There's a reason that one of the principal proponents of a flat tax once told Congressman Linder, "I like your idea better." This individual is now wed to a tax reform proposal he knows is second rate, the flat tax. When we went looking for the best tax reform proposal, we knew it when we saw it, the fair tax. Next criticism, if we have to have a consumption tax, wouldn't a value-added tax be better? The value-added tax has been the most common choice among nations that have moved to a consumption tax model. It's a tax on each step of the manufacturing process in which a business buys a product and adds value to it. For example, in the making of an automobile, an ore company buys equipment and hires workers to get ore out of the ground to sell it to a steel manufacturer. The manufacturer deducts the cost it incurs from the sale price and pays tax on the difference. The steel company sells the steel to an automobile manufacturer or a company that shapes bumpers and pays taxes on the value of the sale minus their cost. And on it goes, all the way down to that car on a showroom floor. It's true that the tax on the increase in value is a very small step at each step of the supply chain, but all those taxes accumulate along the way. By the time the consumer buys the product for final consumption, the total cost of the tax burden is hidden right there in that final price, to be paid by the final consumer. Many economists argue that the VAT is preferable to a sales tax because the cost of administering it are lower and compliance is better. Okay, that's true. In the income tax paradigm, the tax is taken from your paycheck and collected by your employer are remitted to the federal government and have a very high rate of collection. VAT advocates argue that corporations would collect a value-added tax more efficiently and more accurately than retailers would collect the fair tax. In response to our claim that the fair tax sends goods and services into a global economy with no tax component in the price system, they point out that the VAT levied by European companies, for example, is generally rebated to the companies when the product is exported, so that the product goes abroad with no tax component in its price. All of the above statements are true, and all inure to the benefit of the government. But what about private sector businesses? Again, there is the issue of compliance costs. Under the fair tax, businesses will encounter compliance costs only when they're dealing with customers at the retail level. Even then, retail providers would get to keep a small portion of the collected fair tax to cover those costs. With the VAT, businesses throughout the chain of production have to do the paperwork necessary to deduct cost from price. Why go through the extra trouble when there's a better plan on the table? Our concern is more practical. We follow Milton Friedman's observation. The VAT is the most efficient way to raise taxes and the most effective way to increase the size of government. Since the VAT is levied at so many steps along the manufacturing chain, a very small increase raises a significant amount of revenue. The average consumer thinks that this is just a matter of inflation. Europe, whose member nations levy a VAT, taxes its citizens at about 40 to 45% of its entire economy. It has seen virtually no increase in jobs for 25 years. The exception? Ireland. Why? Well, because Ireland reduced the tax burden on its citizens, a move that transformed the small nation into Europe's fastest growing economy. There's one more very important danger associated with the value-added tax. Many countries that use the system also have an income tax. Is that what we want in the U.S.? One year we may be singing the praises of a value-added tax. A few years later, Americans can find themselves with a VAT on top of an income tax. We tax our citizens at about 25% of the economy. We believe we can reduce that burden by moving to a simpler, fairer tax system, and that you, who will see the cost of government every time you buy a loaf of bread, will force a reduction in the tax. One more thing. Can somebody tell us how the VAT untaxes the poor? Okay, the next criticism. If we abolish the high income tax rates paid by the wealthy and completely exempt the poor, won't the middle class end up footing the bill? The answer to this question is definite and twofold. First, if you're a middle-class American living beyond your means today, you definitely will pay more under the fair tax than you do now, and that may not be a bad thing, because living beyond your means isn't something to be proud of. Unfortunately, today's income tax subsidizes debt and penalizes savings, so it's no wonder that many people choose a debt-filled path. Second, you'd be absolutely right about the middle class getting squeezed if we were to repeal only the income tax. In fact, when the President's Advisory Panel on Tax Reform examined and rejected a sales tax to replace the income tax, it did so for exactly that reason. The fair tax, however, proposes to repeal both the income tax and the payroll tax, and that payroll tax, that makes all the difference, because that's the largest tax working Americans pay, and wealthy Americans generally don't pay a dime of it. Now let's look at this in more detail. Before the income tax was instituted, the U.S. government was funded largely by tariffs and excise taxes. After 1913, we began to tax wages. The income tax and the payroll tax are levied on how much money you earn in wages. Today, the average taxpayer is in the 25% tax bracket and pays an additional 7.65%. We can go ahead and round it up to 8% for easy math for the employee's share of the payroll tax that pays for Social Security and Medicare. The Social Security portion of the payroll tax is applied against, well, in 2008, the first $102,000 of wages. The Medicare tax is levied on all wages, no cap. Income from wealth, however, has always been taxed differently. Today, the tax on capital gains and dividends is 15%. That has varied over the years, but since the 1986 tax reform, that tax has been less than the tax on income at the highest levels. In addition, no payroll tax is levied against capital gains or dividends. The lower rate is good for the country, mind you. The capital gains rate especially encourages investment, which is what is needed to create jobs. When we lower the tax rate on capital gains and dividends, we see huge increases in revenues from those sources for two reasons. First, a high capital gains tax rate causes investors to hold on to their investments to avoid the high tax penalty. Second, a low tax rate on dividends encourages corporations to start paying dividends or increase them, thus yielding more revenues to the government. This shows once again that lower tax rates are good for the economy, but now comes the important part. The very first thing wealthy people do when money starts pouring in is to stop getting a wage. They live on their capital gains and dividends and pay a 15% tax rate. They pay nothing to Social Security and Medicare because they have no wages. In 2007, during the presidential election campaign, a lot was made over a statement by Warren Buffett that his tax rate was lower than his secretary's tax rate. Warren Buffett made this argument in saying that he ought to pay more taxes. Well, he could have if he'd wanted to. Just write a check, Warren. The fact is, his secretary was paying income taxes at a higher rate. Warren Buffett, capital gains taxes, a lower rate. The fair tax taxes spending instead of wages. We would all pay the fair tax. Warren Buffett, all of us. Which would fund Social Security and Medicare in addition to general government on 100% of our spending beyond poverty level spending for our household size. The question is, would you rather pay the government a marginal rate of 33% of what you earn or 23% of what you spend? How can the rate be lower and still collect the same amount of income? Because the fair tax consumption base has no special exemptions or exceptions. It's simply that much larger than the current income tax base, which is riddled with loopholes and special treatment. One more thing to consider as we discuss the effect of the fair tax on the middle class. The latest Treasury statistics show a great deal of mobility, generally upward, in lower and middle income levels. Today's middle-income earners aspire to be in the upper income levels in subsequent years, and with a bit of hard work and good decision-making skills, this is how things generally work out. While certain middle-income earners with a high debt-to-income ratio might feel a bit of a bite from the fair tax, the economic growth brought about by the fair tax would quickly propel them into higher income levels, where they'd no longer feel that bite. The fair tax rewards those who live responsibly at all income levels. And what's that we keep saying about getting more of the behavior you reward? Next criticism, the progressive nature of our current tax code is important to me and the fair tax will eliminate it. Still thinking of attacking the fair tax as less progressive than our current system? We hope not. Because we thought we covered that bit in our middle class defense above. But there's definitely more to say on the subject. Only time will tell. But the truth is, the fair tax could be even more progressive than our current system. And here's why. It repeals payroll taxes, which account for 38% of all federal taxes and fall disproportionately on low and middle income wage earners. The regressive payroll tax burdens wages, not dividends, interest, or capital gains, up to $97,000 at 15.3%. It entirely untaxes the poor and reduces the tax burden on the near poor by exempting all consumption up to the poverty line, giving each family a tax-free consumption allowance. It saves more than 80% of the $400 billion plus in compliance costs, yet another hidden tax borne disproportionately by the poor and middle class. It fosters economic growth, which will increase real wages, which will benefit the poor and middle class. Of course, as we all know, whether a tax system is fair is a complicated economic and philosophical question, one that inevitably involves oversimplification and subjective judgment. For our purposes, the real concern is whether taxpayers will have more money in their pockets after the switch to the fair tax than before. If you look at this question from different angles, what you find may surprise you. First, let's examine what effect the fair tax will have on the tax rates of low, middle, and high-income folks. This section will draw on some of the top-notch economic research that went into developing the fair tax in the first place, much of it done by Boston University's Larry Kotlikoff. So it may be a little technical at times. Those of you who want even more econo-speak are free to dip into the footnotes. You'll find them in the book. The research shows that the fair tax will significantly reduce the tax rate on work and savings, thereby substantially lowering the overall tax burdens on current and future workers. Today, marginal tax rates, the amount of tax on the next dollar earned or saved, are higher, in some cases much higher, for almost all American households than they would be under a revenue-neutral fair tax. The current system's tax rate on wages exceeds the fair tax's 23% rate for 9 out of 10 of the household types in the study. For some low- and middle-income households, the tax incurred working under our current tax system was more than twice the 23% fair tax rate. Why? Because some low-income couples with children who receive the earned income tax credit may face a tax of almost 50 cents on the next dollar earned as the earned income tax credit phases out. The fair tax encourages savings with a zero tax rate on savings. This is in stark contrast to the existing tax code, which imposes very high tax rates on saving, ranging from 23 to 54%, depending upon whether the taxpayer is a single person or a married couple. While the rate structure of the current tax code encourages consumption, the fair tax taxes current and future consumption at the same rate, which ends the savings penalty and allows citizens a fair opportunity to save for the future. The future? That's right. Save for the future, and good things will happen. We know this intuitively, and this principle is incorporated into the economics behind the fair tax. To get the full picture, we need to look beyond the how am I going to be treated this year charts tax writers in Washington like to promote. Instead, let's look at the fair tax and how it will affect you over your lifetime. Do you think solely in the short term, or is the long term important to you as well? As any economist would expect, we have good news. The fair tax lifetime tax burden would be lower for all household types, all categories, than under the current system. That's right. Because of the growth, savings, and investment potential inherent in the system, in the course of a lifetime, everybody wins under the fair tax. Single, married, young, old, low income earning, high income earning, everybody, without exception, wins. One recent study confirmed all household types would have lower average lifetime tax rates under the fair tax than under the current system. To determine whether this new tax system would leave people better off than they were, we have to look into the future to compare where we're going to be if the current system remains in place against the future in a fair tax world. Will there be short-term dislocations? Absolutely. Will you owe more in taxes in the first year of a fair tax system than you do today? As we discussed, depending on your spending behavior, you might. But what happens if the current system remains in place? Well, how'd you like to see your payroll taxes double? That's right. More than a doubling of the payroll tax is going to be necessary to fund Social Security. Thank today's wizened citizens for living so long. These increased Social Security taxes will lead to a 21% decline in future after-tax take-home pay. Remember who pays the payroll tax? That's right, wage earners. This giant tax increase, which under the current system can be avoided by only cutting benefits, will result in a major reduction in economic well-being, which can be avoided by switching to the fair tax plan. What does a fair tax future look like? Switching to the fair tax would dramatically increase investment in plant and equipment. Indeed, American capital stock would almost double by 2100. This increased investment would lead to higher productivity, which in turn would increase real wages per unit of labor. Rather than declining by 8% by the end of the century, as it will under the current system, the real wage would now rise by 17%, and that's a 25% difference in workers' real compensation. The pace of the change may be slow, but by 2030, real wages under the fair tax would be 11.5% higher than they would be if the current system stays in place. In transforming the economy's prospect from one of a capital shortage to one of capital deepening, the fair tax would also reduce real interest rates. What home buying, car purchasing, credit card maxing American wouldn't be grateful for that? Interest rate reductions are the gifts that keep on giving, payment after monthly payment. So sure, you say. Of course, the fair tax would be good for the young folks. They get all of the long-term economic benefits. Plus, they'll be saved from the crushing burden of paying for me, the hypothetical older American. But what's in it for me? Honestly, we don't think most grandparents take that view. The World War II generation has always looked out for the welfare of others, and we think that their vote on the fair tax will be no exception. Just in case we're wrong, though, let's see what would happen to them. We'll start with the results of the Kotlikoff study for those born in 1920. The low-income members of this age group would experience a sizable 9.4% increase in their economic well-being. The economic term of art for this increase is welfare gain, but welfare has so many negative connotations, particularly when we're talking about government and taxes, that we prefer to avoid it. Their middle-income contemporaries would experience a moderate 1% economic improvement, while the richer contemporaries would sustain a small 0.4% welfare loss. This picture of substantial gains for low-income group members and modest gains and slight losses for middle and higher-income group members holds for all age groups born before 1970. People born after 1970, on the other hand, will see major improvements in their economic well-being, not just for low-income cohort members, but for middle and high-income members as well. Take the age group born in 2030, low-income members would experience a 26.3% gain, while their middle-income contemporaries would experience a 12.4% gain, and for the high income, a 5% gain. Over the long haul, the fair tax offers a real opportunity to improve the U.S. economy's performance and the well-being of the vast majority of Americans. To begin with, it cuts in half the long-term increase in the effective rate of wage taxation needed to pay the Social Security and health care benefits of an aging country. The improvement in the economy has important implications for the economic well-being of individuals as well. Low-income households would experience a 26.7% gain. Middle-income households, a 10.9% welfare gain. And high-income households, a 4.7% gain. This is a very progressive long-term outcome, but progressivity marks the entire transition. Existing low-income households, whether they are young, middle-aged, or old, would all experience welfare gains ranging from 4.7% to more than 20%. In sum, as it changes our approach from taxing income to taxing consumption and adding a highly progressive prebate. The Fair Tax introduces many progressive elements into our fiscal system, removes one very regressive element, the payroll tax, and provides much better incentives to work and save. It also generates major welfare gains for the poorest members of society, including those now retired and those yet to be born. Once again, the economist Larry Kotlikoff captures our sentiments exactly. Quote, "My preferred reform is the Fair Tax, which has three highly progressive elements. First, thanks to the prebate, poor households would pay no sales taxes in net terms. Second, the reform eliminates our highly regressive FICA tax. Third, the sales tax will effectively tax wealth as well as wages. When the rich spend their wealth and when the workers spend their wages, they will both pay sales taxes. By broadening the effective tax base to include the corpus of wealth, not just the income earned on it, one can lower the required sales tax rate and thereby reduce the tax burden on workers." So are you still worried we're not punishing the rich enough? For those who believe that the rich should be punished with an even greater than 23% tax on their spending, we have a few words of warning. Economic theory and empirical research demonstrate that attempts to target the wealthy with higher marginal rates have their own negative consequences. First, the highest income groups have the wherewithal to arrange their finances to avoid the tax, and the surtax on the wealthy creates only the appearance that they are paying at a higher tax rate. Tax planning is a lucrative profession because the professionals are successful at what they are doing. Throw more high rates at them and we'll only be creating more tax planners, not more federal revenue. Second, targeting these individuals would inevitably have negative effects on low and middle income groups. As the economist Michael Schuyler has pointed out, when a tax on upper-income individuals causes them to work and save less, part of the tax burden is shifted to the rest of the population, including lower-income individuals. As high-productivity, upper-income people cut the time and the intensity of their work effort due to a higher tax rate on their labor effort, they employ fewer people to work with them, and their reduced presence in the workplace lowers the productivity and incomes of other workers. Way to go, Mr. Schuyler. Okay, Mr. Economist Schuyler continues. As upper-income individuals save and invest less due to a higher tax rate on their capital income, capital formation drops, which reduces the amount of plant, equipment, buildings, and other structures. The smaller capital stock decreases the productivity of labor, thereby reducing jobs and wages. Because of these tax-induced effects, middle and lower-income workers indirectly bear a significant part of the burden of the taxes on higher-income individuals. Middle and lower-income earners also suffer from a lower stock market if they own shares directly or through pension funds. Middle and lower-income workers additionally bear some of the tax as consumers because output is reduced and consumers at all income levels must make do with fewer, higher-priced goods and services. Wow, that was exhausting. Look, if you're going to develop a completely new tax system for America and then write a book that addresses criticisms of that plan in a comprehensive manner, you've got to expect to handle some difficult language somewhere along the way. But it's time to move on. Next criticism. I've been saving all my life. I paid taxes on all that money I put into my savings accounts. Now you want to tax me again when I spend that money. That's not fair. By now, the response to this criticism should be self-evident, but we'll address it here so nobody will accuse us of ignoring it. Yes, you've been saving all your life, and yes, you've already paid income taxes on that money you put into your savings and investment account, and yes, under the Fair Tax, you're going to be taxed when you take that money out and spend it. So, what else is new? Think for a moment. You're going to be taxed anyway. When you take that money out of your savings or investment account and spend it, either you're going to pay the embedded taxes that are out there in those products and services, or you're going to pay the fair tax, six of one, half a dozen of the other. However, and here's your bonus, under the fair tax, you're going to be getting the prebate. Everything you buy with those savings is going to cost pretty much the same, plus you're going to have that prebate check every month. So does it still sound like a bad deal? And now, the final criticism. Drum roll, please. It's not going to happen. The fair tax is a great idea, but it just isn't going to happen. This criticism is particularly vexing. These people aren't saying that the fair tax isn't a good idea. They're not saying it won't work. They're not saying that the research is flawed or that the fair tax is being misrepresented to the people. They just say it's a good idea, but it isn't going to happen. So let's hop into the Wayback Machine to see if we can find any other time in the history of our country where people were saying it's a good idea, but it just isn't going to happen. We'll set the dials to 1776. George Washington and his ragtag army are fighting for our country's independence from Great Britain. Many modern readers may be surprised to learn this, but at no time during our Revolutionary War did the majority of the colonists support the idea of independence. From 1776 until victory in 1783, it was the minority who either fought for independence or supported those who did. The majority, they sat around saying, hey, good idea, but it's not going to happen. Is this what remains of the American spirit today? Millions of dollars are spent, hundreds of thousands of volunteers line up to develop and promote a tax reform plan that could turn the tide economically and politically in our country, and we just walk away muttering, never gonna happen? New England is full of 200-year-old headstones, marking the graves of people who, instead of saying, it isn't going to happen, said, this can happen, but only if I get behind it and do my part. How sad it would be if the fair tax came so very close to reality, then failed legislatively because a few people, people who could really have helped, people who could have made such a positive difference, just shrugged their shoulders and said, hey, good idea, but I don't see it happening. As the Reverend Robert Schuller is fond of saying, if it's going to be, it's up to me. Basketball players have taken to repeating the phrase in their practice drills while passing the ball around. If it's going to be, it's up to me. It's a mantra repeated by doers, by people who are driven to succeed. The fair tax, as we've said, would be the most massive transfer of power from government to people in the history of our country. It is, in every respect, a 21st century American revolution. Thankfully, for every person who would dismiss it with not going to happen, there are dozens more who are willing to dedicate their time and energy and even money to an effort to see that it does. There very well may be some good criticisms that we've missed here. It isn't intentional. We're not dodging anybody, but even if we did miss one, we hope we've given you enough grounding to handle those criticisms on your own. If you find yourself confronting a critique we haven't addressed, first consider whether the criticism really has to do with the substance or principles of the fair tax. It's not one of those, I don't like the fair tax and who gets to say it's fair anyway. You can safely dismiss that. Save your energy for the more important questions about fundamental tax reform. If the criticism does address one of the principles, try looking closer. Is it really a criticism of the fair tax or of the way it is expressed in H.R. 25? If the latter, you're welcome to give it some thought. And if you come up with some ideas on how to improve the language of the fair tax bill, feel free to send your suggestions to us or the folks at fairtax.org. If the criticism you're wrestling is a more substantial matter, take things one step further. In some cases, you may find that the critic is simply mistaken about the particulars of the fair tax. Often, a simple explanation will put the criticism to rest. In other cases, the criticisms may be valid. They may point to some less than desirable effect of the fair tax in the short or long term. If that's the case, it's up to you to sit down and decide whether those ill effects would be important enough to scuttle the entire fair tax idea. As we've said before, if this were easy, we'd have done it already. But with a volunteer base of hundreds of thousands of thoughtful taxpayers applying themselves to these questions and helping us with these answers, we're as confident that, criticisms and all, the fair tax is the best opportunity for tax reform and economic growth this country has ever seen. Okay, in this chapter, we talk about the fair tax grassroots army and its victories. If anybody tells you that all you need to do is cast your vote in November and we can take the fair tax to victory, they're leading you astray. Casting your vote for a candidate for economic change and growth, good first step, but implementing the principles of the fair tax is going to require more. We hope this book has convinced you to be a part of the process if you aren't already. And if you already are, if you're part of the "if it's going to be, it's up to me" crowd and not the "it's not going to happen" crowd, we want to take a few pages to brag about you. In 2007, Congressman Linder and myself went to Ames, Iowa for the straw poll. I gotta tell you, folks, I like corn dogs. And do they know how to do corn dogs in Ames, Iowa? I was a sword swallower throwing those corn dogs down. Anyway, at the straw poll, clearly Mitt Romney had the biggest presence. Estimated that he spent $3 to $5 million to get to the straw poll, renting buses to bring in supporters from each of Iowa's 90 counties. In polling running up to the event, he was the clear leader. Rudy and John McCain chose not to participate. Fred Thompson wasn't a declared candidate yet. Who stole the show? Americans for Fair Taxation, that's who. There were fair tax volunteers all over the grounds. You couldn't walk 10 feet without bumping into somebody with a fair tax sticker on his or her shirt, a fair tax hat, or a sign. Romney, an opponent of the fair tax, had his supporters wearing yellow T-shirts. About a third of them had a fair tax sticker on their shirt. When their votes were cast, Romney, the winner, 31%. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, who spent less than $150,000, came in second with 18% of the vote. How did he do that? Simple. He ran on the fair tax. After the caucus, Huckabee told us something interesting. All the candidates have been asked in debates whether they would sign a fair tax if it passed by Congress. Huckabee responded by saying that was the wrong question. The president won't have a chance to sign it unless he is willing to sell it. I am willing to sell it. We all know, then, what happened in the Iowa caucuses a couple of months later. The winner, Mike Huckabee. This is going to be an important issue in the presidential election, perhaps the most important of the past 30 years. This election can alter the course of the country's history. Fair tax advocates have no inclination to let the candidates rest during the campaign season. Every candidate will be asked at every stop whether he or she supports the fair tax. In fact, every member of Congress confronts questions about the fair tax at every public event. That is what the thousands of volunteers are bringing to this debate on a daily basis, and we cannot thank them enough. When Dan Boren, a Democrat from Oklahoma, signed on, he told us that the fair tax was everywhere in his district. From the beginning of the research to the introduction of H.R. 25, we knew there was no way to convince enough politicians that we should throw out the tax code for a new idea. With roughly half of the lobbyists in Washington making a living off of gaming the current code, we knew we would never get enough support to start a groundswell, not in that town. Instead, we concluded the idea must move the nation first, and then the nation has to move the Congress. That seems to be happening, and not just in Iowa. The million-plus people who have signed petitions of support for the fair tax are talking about it every day. The proponents who respond to the negative articles with thoughtful and respectful responses are educating the nation. The 300,000 volunteers who have offered their time will help swamp Washington with phone calls, emails, and letters. This is all great, but it's not enough. We need to do more. it's likely that less than 40% of the nation has heard of the fair tax. It's just as likely that half of Congress has no real idea exactly how it would work. If you're inclined to get involved, contact fairtax.org and sign up. If you want to be a citizen co-sponsor, well, then go to johnlinder.com and sign up. You'll get updates and instructions right there for your action. Finally, and this is important, members of Congress hear from lobbyists all the time, but the requests they really respond to come from their constituents. Obviously, with thousands of fair tax advocates across the country, there's no way we can mention everyone who has had an impact on the fair tax success. But we're not going to let that stop us from trying to recognize a few. The fair tax effort is nothing without men and women like you participating in it, advocating for it, voting based on it. So we want to cite and thank as many as we can. Your state has leaders just as strong as these. Track them down and ask them how you can help. Gene Key in Georgia leads the Georgia Fair Tax Organization. Last year, he organized 5 workshops in Atlanta, in Georgia, and another in Alabama, where interested individuals showed up for 3-hour informational meetings. He typically has about 100 people show up to learn about the fair tax, people who would then take what they learn and share it in churches, civic groups, and businesses. Angela Bean in Georgia typically leads those meetings, answering questions about the bill from newcomers and veterans alike. She very likely knows as much about the fair tax as we do. Lori Klein in Arizona has spoken on scores of radio talk shows and crisscrossed the nation in support of the fair tax. She has helped raise funds for the national campaign, has worked closely with fairtax.org to bring elected officials to the cause. Lori can be found at